The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Well, hello there. This is Fred Brack reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting our podcast for over 10 years. You know, I just realized I call it a podcast because I think in terms of podcasting, but many of you are listening to the original recording. When it is broadcast or directly on the reading service or one of the repeat times. But it is available as a podcast, and I'll talk about that a little later. And so, want to talk to the Carter Glass people? They can be reached at 919-781-1973. One more time here at the end of November, we return to the November 2020 edition of Our State magazine, celebrating North Carolina. We've been reading about a mill revival this month, but today, being the last reading of the month and the last reading in this issue, we are going to cover, as we always do, the dynamic decade of the year, which in this case is the 1960s. This month's episode is entitled In the Spirit of Service. The Cherokee Boys Club transforms the lives of its members and the community with help from its manager. Although not a Cherokee by blood, his devotion earns him honorary status in the tribe. Written, as always, by Philip Girard. A farming accident in 1958 detours an aspiring officer from a military career into a new vocation, one that will help transform the community of the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians. In February, Raymond E. Kinsland graduates from North Carolina State University with a B.S. in vocational education and a state teaching certificate. Lean, dark-haired, and vigorous, he plans to enlist in the Army with his college buddies once they, too, graduate in May. Meantime, he returns to his father's dairy farm in Cherokee to make himself useful. The Bureau of Indian Affairs superintendent learns that Kinsland is home and offers him a temporary job teaching at the Cherokee Central School, replacing an instructor whose father is very ill. One of Kinsland's three daughters, Dr. Deborah Forst, recalls what happens next. The superintendent's secretary came out to the dairy barn on my grandpa's farm and had a portable typewriter and typed my dad's application. That was on a Friday or a Saturday, and that Monday he started working at the school. His specialty includes hands-on agriculture education. In May of that year, he was baling hay where the Cherokee Elementary School used to be, and there was some hay stuck in the hay baler. Forst says he reached there to get it out and it cut three of his fingers off. Of course, he talks in great detail about picking them up and putting them in his pocket and going to the hospital and having his fingers sewn back up. But what's more significant is that he talks about the fact that had he not cut his fingers off, he would have joined the Army. In the early 1960s, the Eastern Band of Cherokees, like many tribes around the country, is struggling. An influx of tourist dollars since the end of the war has helped its economy somewhat, but poverty is widespread and jobs are few. To find good wages, many young people leave the Quella Boundary, the proper name of what many refer to as the Cherokee Reservation, located in the remote western mountains. Now the federal government presents an opportunity, one of many programs in President Lyndon B. Johnson's War on Poverty, is the Neighborhood Youth Corps administered by the Office of Economic Opportunity. Since 1932, the Boys Farm Club has provided a chance for Cherokee boys to practice the skills they learn in their vocational classes. Kinsland helps reorganize the club with a more ambitious mission, and in May 1964, the tribe appoints him general manager of the newly incorporated Cherokee Boys Club. As a bona fide nonprofit, it applies for and receives a significant Neighborhood Youth Corps grant. The club finds employment for as many as 150 boys and girls in lunchrooms, offices, and building trades. They work part-time during the school year and full-time during the summer. It's a modest beginning, but it expands quickly, providing vital services across the Cherokee community. The club places student workers in the hospital, the Bureau of Indian Affairs Office, BIA, and the Cherokee Historical Association. And where the jobs come training and mentoring, with a strong message to stay in school, complete high school, and earn a diploma. Scooter McCoy gets to know Kinsland well during his days playing football for Cherokee High School, where Kinsland is a loyal volunteer of the athletic program and never misses a game. He often gives the team an inspirational talk before the big game. He understands from a very early age that there's always young eyes upon you, and the things that he was able to teach even us as players and future coaches was being able to lead by example and how we carry ourselves in the community. McCoy goes on to become the head football coach at Cherokee High, emulating his mentor's style of leadership by example. He's had an educational experience every day of his life with someone here. By late 1964, the club is operating 12 school buses purchased by the tribal council. Seasoned BIA drivers quit their secure jobs to work for the Boys Club, a dramatic show of confidence in the new Cherokee-owned venture. By 1966, the fleet expands to 20 buses. Kinsland personally conducts safety drills for all students each year, teaching them how to evacuate through the emergency door in the event of an accident. He is famous for knowing the name of nearly every student who comes through his course and for his repertoire of funny stories. The club wins BIA contracts for paving roads and mowing rights of way and operates a fleet of trucks. It runs a garage and body shop. It expands into providing food service for the school, and parking and shuttle bus service for the outdoor drama Unto These Hills. The club's impact is so profound that it is singled out for praise in the BIA Commissioner's report to President Johnson. Don Jensen, superintendent of the Cherokee Indian Agency, reports there are more jobs here than there are qualified Indians to hold them. The tribal council appoints three representatives to recommend and oversee the new program sponsored by the Office of Economic Opportunity, and later creates community action program boards to administer the funds. Again, the Boys Club provides leadership, engendering a sense of pride and purpose for the whole community. Part of a nationwide movement by the National Indian Youth Council and other pan-tribal organizations to reclaim their heritage and gain control over their own affairs. From the time she is a little girl, Tanya Carroll knows Kinsland as a man remarkable for his humility. He's a close friend of her grandfather's and sings with him in a gospel quartet called The Sportsman. They make a record and sell it to raise money to support the building of Children's Home Cottages, another program of the Boys Club. As a student, Carroll participates in school bus safety training under Kinsland and goes on to become director of the Leadership Institute named for him. Carroll recalls him fondly. He was a very humble man, and every time he saw you, he would speak to you, shake your hand, ask how you're doing, and if you needed anything. And if there was anything he could do for you, he would definitely do it. In addition to three daughters, Kinsland and his wife, Jerry, raised several foster children. Kinsland is recognized with a string of honors, the Distinctive Service Award from the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians, the Order of the Longleaf Pine, even an honorable doctorate from West Carolina University. In 1968, he is made an honorary member of the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians with the name Dista Li Skri A Ni Wivni. Well, that's the best I can do. Helper of Young Men. The integrity of that gesture, to me, may carry more weight than someone who was simply born into it through blood, McCoy says in a video tribute to Kinsland. His character and his leadership and the efforts and the sacrifices he's made over the years made him so attractive to our tribe that we asked him to be part of our family. How did an outsider manage to become such an integral part of the tribal community? He came in and got to know the people and figured out ways he could help out the community, Carol remembers. By utilizing the people in the community and not just telling them what they needed, but working with them and asking them what they needed. Kinsland seems to be always on duty. No matter the day or the hour, in addition to his responsibilities for the club, he announces the high school's home football games, drives school buses to most away games, serves as a deacon and Sunday school teacher at the Equoni Baptist Chapel, and serves as unofficial archivist for the Cherokee community. His ethic embodies the seven Cherokee core values: group, harmony, strong individual character, spirituality, sense of place, honoring the past, educating the children, and a sense of humor. The Boys Club becomes an exemplar of the Gaduji, or cooperative work group, helping those in need with no expectation of getting something in return. His daughter, Deborah Forst, who goes on to become principal of Cherokee High School, says, "Had he joined the Army, we don't know how the Cherokee Boys Club would be here today." The Boys Club begins with just a dozen employees, less than $100,000 in funding, and big ambition. Under Roy Kinsland's more than half a century of leadership, it eventually employs more than 500 people, using its budget of $40 million to offer services throughout the Quala boundary, offering seeds and fertilizer to farmers, helping with trash removal for the National Park Service, providing building supplies for housing, equipping a new ambulance for the rescue squad, and always more jobs. While the impacts on the economy and quality of life are significant, Kinsland's real legacy is the cadre of men and women several generations deep who take on leadership roles in tribal government, the Indian Health Services, and the BIA in the Cherokee community and beyond, carrying on in the spirit of harmony and service. Coming next month in this series, a new bridge carries Wilmington into a fresh decade. You are listening to Our State Magazine on the North Carolina Reading Service. If you have any questions or comments, call the studios 919-832-5138. And now, core values. Though it's been battered by hurricanes over the decades, one museum that celebrates the creativity and tenacity of Down East residents refuses to let storms drown out its culture. Written by Kate Doty. Have you figured out where this museum is located? I'll tell you the name of the article again. Core Values. Roy Willis's Decoy Collection tells the history of Core Sound, the narrow body of water that connects Cape Lookout to the mainland. Curlews, dowitches, and red knots, the waterfowl and shorebirds that locals have depended on for sustenance and sport, are represented in balsa and other woods at the Core Sound Museum and Heritage Center, the building on Harker's Island that relates the stories of those who call the sound their home. The collection of more than 100 artifacts from Willis, a pioneer of the craft and an informal historian who died at 79, after a day of carving with friends, rested in glass cases in what was affectionately known as Billy's Room, the living room in the museum. Then in late August 2018, Hurricane Florence, a massive Cape Verde storm, began forming in the Atlantic, and it was charted to make a bullseye of North Carolina's coast. Some residents packed up and moved inland. Others, like Pam Morris, the museum's exhibitions director, stayed behind to protect their livestock and houses. Everyone knows what happened next. At first, a ferocious Category 4 storm, Florence finally landed on the coast as a Category 1, with wind gusts of 106 miles per hour recorded at Cape Lookout, just beyond the sound. But instead of moving swiftly up the seaboard, the storm settled in and pounded down east with rain. After 48 hours, Harker's Island had received more than 2 feet. Winds sheared off shingles from the roof of the museum's northern side, and all the rain poured down the building's sheetrock, soaking its administrative offices and exhibit halls, saturating its carpets, and cascading over the exhibits that had been carefully wrapped in plastic and protected in rubber tubs. Morris and Karen Amspacher, the museum's stalwart director, were finally able to get into the building days after the rain stopped. The destruction they found was difficult to comprehend, but as heartbreaking as it was, it marked the beginning of a new chapter for the museum, the sound's resilient people, and the land itself. There are two ways to get from the mainland to Harker's Island, on the two-lane road over the only bridge or by boat. Either way, you'll at some point end up on Island Road, the paved backbone that runs the 3-mile length of the island. The road winds past homes and churches and seafood shacks under storm-beaten live oak trees that shade the faded asphalt. At the end of the road is the water, the core sound, brackish, brilliant at high noon, gray at twilight, and always lapping at the edges of the islanders' lives. Across Island Road from those waters is the museum, an expansive gray cypress-sided building with an unbridled view of the sound. Nominally, it is a collection of historical artifacts and artwork that tells the story of the Coarse Sound people's rich past. But as Down East continues to recover from Hurricane Florence and prepare for storms ahead, the museum has become a source of steadiness for islanders and Coarse Sounders, and a font of optimism for what is possible after a long recovery. "I think we have something to prove," says Amspacher, an island native who has worked tirelessly to establish the museum's purpose and expand its reach. "It's not just this museum, it's not just the island, it's this community. And so we capture that." The museum grew out of the efforts of the Core Sound Decoy Carvers Guild, created to preserve the waterfowl carving heritage that is embedded into the history of eastern North Carolina. But since it opened in 1993, the museum has grown into a deeply rooted historical archive, a science education center, and a community space where islanders gather to remember, to observe, and to celebrate. "Community work and waterfowl are a big piece of it," Amspacher says of the museum's purpose, "but it's also the story that we've told about boat building and commercial fishing, and this place and community and storms and lighthouses and life-saving services, because at the end of the day, it's about people." After the storm passed, the work began anew. "This whole room was wet," Amspacher says, standing in the vaulted 3-story exhibit hall, now redolent with the scent of new construction. "The carpet was wet from there," she points, "to there, as well as all the sheetrock. And then came the mold." Willis's artifacts, the red knot and root head decoys, were safe behind glass, but they needed to be moved. Over the next several months, the museum's thousands of artifacts and artworks, duck decoys, pieces of island life, decades-old hunting rifles and shotguns, were carefully wrapped by professional art handlers and shipped in 311 boxes and crates to an art storage facility in Charlotte. Then the building's recovery began. 75% of the sheetrock was removed, along with 90% of the flooring. The renovations, including a new metal roof, mold remediation, and the moving and conservation of thousands of artifacts, cost in the neighborhood of $3 million. But right outside the museum's doors was its community. The Kay bankers' descendants and others who called Core Sound home after the storm, Amspatcher and her staff worked with island partners to raise thousands for Down East storm relief, providing food and temporary housing to residents and helping rebuild homes. Morris's home that she shares with her mother needed thousands of dollars worth of renovations, which she negotiated with her insurance company even as she tried to wrap her arms around the damage at the museum. That was 2 years ago. On a more recent Friday morning, the whine of power tools sings out as Amspatcher, Morris, and other museum workers bustle around, moving boxes, wielding brooms, and debating what should go where. As the seasons passed over the island, sheetrock and fresh paint took the place of mold and damage. "We're getting back into our offices today," Morris says with glee. Morris, who manages the collections and pretty much everything else, says that when she finally visited her third-floor office after the rain stopped, she found her computer was underwater. After the mold specialists cleared out and the staff was left to assess the damage, vinyl letters from a former exhibit still clung to one wall. Response, recovery, resilience. The staff and the community took that as their creed. "Those words remain," Amspatcher says. "Those words wound over us." Willis's decoys had survived other storms. First Isabel in 2003 and then Irene in 2011, both of which had left the pieces submerged in mud in an old storage room on Willis's property. In a way, Florence elevated their status. The decoys, packed away with care by the insurance company, were handled and treated as fine art. They, along with the museum's other artifacts, were returned to Harker's Island in mid-March when Amspacher and Morris happily got to unpacking. They were eager to rehang a painting by artist Jack Saylor that depicts decoy collection after a hunt. They placed a detailed carving of a tundra swan, a bird that migrates south to eastern North Carolina every fall, back in its rightful spot on the hearth of the museum's fireplace. Although COVID-19 put the museum's plans on hold, it has now reopened following social distancing guidelines, and the staff has been able to get back to the work they love, telling the story of Core Sound and its people, its duck decoys, its waterfowl heritage, and its communities that look out for each other. The island's 1,200 residents will face more storms, and they will pull together. Harker's Island is home, and most of it would not have it any other way. "To me, home is born in you," Amspacher says. "We use that quote from Wallace Stegner a lot. Tell me where you're from, and I'll tell you who you are." That's very true here. Up in the museum's lookout tower, the view is profound. Past the live oaks and the Cape Lookout ferry landing is the sound, hemmed for miles by Shackelford Banks, where the wild ponies roam. Beyond that is Cape Lookout, where, even on cloudy days, the 163-foot-tall lighthouse punctuates the sky, and always, always there is the water, the gentle lapping at low tide, the white caps on a windy day, and the roar of the Atlantic Ocean. Amspacher leans on the tower's railings and tells of her roots. Her grandmother was born over on the banks, and her family migrated across the water around the turn of the 20th century. Her Down East accent strengthens as she describes her home. "I'm proud that my crowd came from the banks and carved out a life from all that sand," she says. "I'm proud that I grew up in a community where if someone was in trouble, they took care of them." She lives in Marshallburg now after years up in Boone with a daughter on the island and a son in Brooklyn. For now, the wind blows gently, even as a pandemic and yet another hurricane season are upon us. Even before coronavirus came ashore, Amspacher and Morris and all who support and love the museum saw their work as the dawn of a new day, a chance to reset the museum for a new generation, to create new exhibits and engage a new audience, to establish a sturdy new home for a history long in the making. The Storm has been a very deep experience as a person and a family, a community. Thomas Bacher says, I've never been more proud than to be part of this museum, knowing that the work of my people is finally getting its rightful place in our state's history. The Core Sound Waterfowl Museum is at 1785 Island Road, Harkers Island. You can find them on the web at coresound.com. Well, we have time for just a little bit more. There's a page here entitled Must Visit Museums. And it says U.S. Army Airborne Special Operations Museum. Standing proud and triumphant, rifle at the ready, Iron Mike, a 16-foot-tall statue of a U.S. paratrooper, greets visitors to the U.S. Army Airborne and Special Operations Museum, known as ASOM, in Fayetteville. Inside the museum's five-story open lobby, a 1940s-era soldier, harnessed in a fully deployed round parachute, celebrates the first members of the Army Airborne Parachute Test Platoon. Throughout ASOM, exhibits recount the battles that soldiers have been part of, from World War II to Vietnam, to the ongoing war on terrorism, as well as the sacrifices they have made to the dedication they continue to show. There's a picture here of the front of the museum. It has a big raised structure in the middle, a lot of glass and steel work, steel girders holding it up there, and then there's a circle in front of the museum. You can drive around the circle, but in the center of the circle is grass. In the center of the grass is another circle of concrete, and then in the center of the concrete there's another little grassy circle, and in the center of that is the 16-foot-tall statue of the paratrooper. And then they show the picture of inside the 1940s-era soldier harnessed into a fully deployed parachute. You can see the parachute. It looks like it's kind of green and white. The green and white splotches all over it. And, of course, the lines are coming down from it. And the paratrooper is, boy, covered with a lot of stuff. It must be a pack on the back. We can't see that, but we see a pack on the front, and below the pack hangs another bag, canvas bag that's filled with something, and of course heavily laced boots coming up the paratrooper's legs. U.S. Army Airborne and Special Operations Museum is on 100 Bragg Boulevard in Fayetteville, asomf.org. And that, my friends, is all the time we have for today's episode of Our State Magazine. Hope you enjoyed it, and that you'll be sure to listen next time when we break the cover on the December 2020 issue of Our State Magazine. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our State Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Comments, questions, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening.